The Department of Justice and data. Why do they want to regulate the flows? The DOJ just put out a new rule entitled Provisions Regarding Access to Americans' Bulk Sensitive Data and Government-Related Data by Countries of Concern, which, according to Stuart Baker of the Cyberlaw podcast, is one of the most ambitious and sweeping new initiatives in national security over the past few years. To discuss, I have on Devin DeBacker of Lee Licata, host of the National Security Division of the Department of Justice, and also DOJ's first guest to grace the China Talk airwaves. So what does the DOJ have to do with national security?
Yeah, so there's a whole division in DOJ called the National Security Division. You know, the name speaks for itself, but it was set up post 9/11 to consolidate a lot of the different national security functions that were already happening in the department, from things like terrorism prosecutions to the use of foreign surveillance authorities. And all of these were consolidated in sort of that post 9/11 consolidation of, you know, with DHS and with the National Security Division and so on. When you think of DOJ, you think of, and you think of lawyers, you think of prosecutors, you think of litigators. And I think the National Security Division, you know, very much fits that mold, right? There are prosecutors, there are litigators who you use the civil and criminal laws to combat national security threats. And they do that in a lot of different ways. You've got the counter-espionage and export control section that investigates and prosecutes espionage and sabotage and sanctions violations and export controls violations. They also are responsible for the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is about making sure that the American people know the sources of political influence in the United States, especially when the sources are foreign and they may be trying to influence public opinion. I've got the Office of Intelligence, which is responsible for assisting and overseeing the use of legal authorities to conduct intelligence operations and surveillance. This is, you know, FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You've got the Law and Policy Office, which helps develop sort of DOJ and interagency policies on national security matters. And then you've got our section, which is the Foreign Investment Review section, which is a little bit different.
So, like, you know, most of the headlines that the National Security Division makes are for prosecuting terrorists, helping the government spy on people with FISA, you know, doing these like weird indictments of Chinese hackers that, you know, are not really going to be in American jails anytime soon, but like are pretty fun to read. You know, is it like, who are like the weirdos who don't want to do prosecutions and want to write regs? Like, what is the vibe of this here?
I was going to say, we're a little bit of a different breed in fierce, right? We're the only people not arresting anyone to solve national security problems, right? But we're the people who are thinking about, you know, the kind of new set of national security risk in the economic space that, you know, comes from foreign ownership or foreign-owned companies that operate here or firms in our technology supply chain or, you know, as we're going to talk about, companies that are seeking access to data, right? So we are the weirdos that look at some of those different issues, you know, and using a whole different set of tools to try and mitigate that kind of risk.
That's a better answer than I was going to give, which is that you've got a bunch of former burned out litigators here who don't want to do the prosecutions and litigations anymore and want to try a different tack.
So are your hours better or worse? What's the energy? How's the energy different?
I don't think the hours are necessarily better.
We go through those cycles just as anybody else does where your work ramps up. I think, you know, like I said, we're a little bit of a different breed, though. I think many of us really love this work in a way that, you know, the hours don't bother us.
Set in front of his boss.
Look, that's my performance review.
When did the U.S. government start to care about data flows? Why don't you give us a history lesson?
I think that, you know, just take a step back, right? I mean, 10 years ago, a national security law is about, you know, 10 years ago, give or take, is about when you start to see the sort of shift in the geopolitical landscape, right? Shift towards China, shift towards the risks associated or the risks that China presents in different fora. And one of those risks is data, right? I mean, you know, saw in, I believe it was at the end of the Obama administration, President Obama publicly blocked a transaction involving the acquisition of a hotel chain.
We're going to skip Grindr. That's my favorite one.
And so, you know, you start to see that, you see, you know, Team Telecom gets formalized. And I think with this sort of shift towards China as a real national security matter, I mean, that's when we start to think about, well, look, you've got that. You've got the rise of AI. You've got the rise of big data analytics. You've got the rise of communications infrastructure and the data threat, you know, and the data threat has always been there, but it takes on a new level of heightened scrutiny in the digital age.
And I'll just add to that. So a lot of this comes to a head in 2021, right? So the beginning of the process that made this executive order started then. And a lot of that arose out of a host of CFIUS cases where data issues were coming up, out of Team Telecom subsea cable reviews that were raising a lot of issues about cloud services and data security. And there was sort of a recognition by DOJ and the administration of, we need a different approach to solve this problem, right? So 2.5-3 years ago now, you know, we started the thinking around what became this EO, only to get us now. But yeah, it's been at least a whole decade's worth of work to get us to today.
And actually, just to, I mean, talk about history for a minute. I mean, I tend to think of the data problem as it's a new twist on an old problem, right? It's other countries want information, right? They want if it's communications, if it's intelligence, what have you, right? They want information for their national security goals, which are often counter to our national security goals. And so, you know, you look back 100 years to World War I. I mean, what's one of the first things the British do, right? They cut the sub cable, they cut the telegraph cables, right? What does that do? That redirects the communications, right? The German communications onto British lines, right? And the whole point of that was to get information. Now it's very different in the digital age. We're not talking about telegraphs and Morse code and the rest of it. We're talking about, you know, heaps and heaps of data. But I think at bottom, it's still a counterintelligence concern.
Sure. So let's start with the like meta question. My and your and everyone else's security clearance was hacked by the Chinese government about 10 years ago. You know, like anything can be stolen. You know, how effective can any sort of regulations or compliance checks around data flows end up being in the 21st century?
So I think that's a good point. You know, we call that sort of malicious cyber activity the backdoor, right? As you say, anything that can be stolen through cyber activities. And the U.S. government obviously is going to great lengths to bolster the country's cyber posture and to try and protect the backdoor, right? But this gets at sort of a corollary problem, which is the front door. Totally legitimate commercial activities that may provide an adversarial nation with access to the same data that could otherwise be stolen through the back door as well, right? We see that the need to protect both doors and to ensure that we have a posture that looks at all the ways which an adversary could seek access to this data, right? For all the work we can do to protect the back door, if the same data can be bought on the open market from a data broker, then it doesn't do you a whole lot of good to keep protecting the back door. So we have to do both.
Yeah, it's one vector of access, right? And the front door is one vector of access, and it's a particularly low cost, uncomplicated vector, right? And we've got it wide open. And so the idea is, well, let's shut down the low cost, uncomplicated vector to buying data, to accessing data through compulsion, political and legal compulsion, and force adversaries to engage if they want data to choose harder, costlier, more time-consuming ways of doing that.
So Devin, on the one hand, the National Security Division is writing indictments of Chinese hackers, and on the other, you're kind of like a jobs program for them.
You know, I should put that in our next budget submission. That's a great way to put it. No, I think the idea here is that we're, you know, it's different tools in the toolbox, and we're, you know, not to strain that metaphor, but we're trying to make sure those tools work together to address the problem. And I do think there are synergies that develop, right? I mean, you just saw, right, the NatSec cyber program gets stood up, and I think the idea there is to consolidate those tools that we use to address the backdoor problem, and we'll address the front door. Look, if the result of this is it pushes adversaries to have to rely on harder and more complicated measures, and that results in more cyber prosecutions, then I would say, you know, that's part of the goal is to force them to rely on harder and more complicated measures, right? Before they didn't do it at all, but.
Gotcha. So, So, you know, you okay? So let's talk process for a little bit. 2021 to 2024 is a not insignificant chunk of your two lives. You know, like, in what world does this take 6 months? In what world does this never happen? Like, how what was the sort of arc here to get to where we are today?
Why don't I talk a little bit about what the general process is, sure, and you can dive into the specifics. So I think, you know, I've got a little bit of an interesting background when it comes to interagency policy dynamics. I've seen it from, I think, the three different vantage points that matter, which is the White House side, the Office of Legal Counsel, which ends up having to review and sign off on any presidential actions and any DOJ rules. The perspective of the agency that's actually the implementing agency in my current job. And so, you know, a process like this, your listeners may be familiar with it, but the interagency process it's a very iterative process, right? And so you identify some problem, right? Some problems identified. Maybe it's a problem because of a specific case. Maybe it's a problem. It's a bottom-up problem that gets identified. Maybe it's a top-down problem where someone says, hey, there's this issue and we need to address it more strategically. And I think this was a combination of both. You know, that problem gets identified. You think, okay, you get the agencies together. The National Security Council gets the agencies together and says, you know, how are we going to address this problem? Should we address this problem? Who should be responsible for addressing it? You know, what are the tools in the toolkit? And it's an iterative process where every agency brings to bear their equities, their expertise, their resources. And it's a very formal process, right? And you have a meeting and there are due outs and someone's going to come up with an idea and spell out what an idea might look like. And then that gets tested against the other agencies and all of their comments and feedback. And then you go back and you revise that. And then that gets tested again against the agencies and their feedback. And maybe you have to have higher level discussions. Maybe you need lower level working groups. And it's just a very iterative process to ensure that all the equities are taken account of, all the angles are thought of. How is this going to be messaged? How are we going to talk to allies about this? How are we going to talk to non-allies about this? How are we going to talk to industry about this? How is it actually going to be implemented? Will it be effective? What's the economic impact? Are we actually addressing the risk? Are there unforeseen consequences that we're not thinking about that we should be thinking about, and so on? And so you go through that process, and it takes a while, right? I mean, especially with something that's, I think, is I'll use the groundbreaking as this. I think it takes a while, right? You've got a whole host of agencies with relevant equities, dozen plus. You can see them in the executive order. They're listed out. And at some point, you hopefully get to having a draft executive order that you can take to the president and that his cabinet can recommend that he issue. That's the process of coming to an executive.
And so I'll just add, so over the last 3 years, I think there were two things we really grappled with through that process. The first was, you know, are we actually addressing the risk, right? And how we define the types of data that are covered here, identifying which countries would be covered, determining what transactions would be prohibited and restricted. And then the second was how do we ensure there are not unintended economic consequences, right? Certainly, this will have some impact on certain parts of the US economy that do business with these countries and their companies. And so how do we ensure that the impact of this is not disproportionate to the risk we seek to address? That took a long time with such a novel concept to work through those issues. And remember, up until we started this, the entire approach that the US government deployed to address this risk was case-by-case reviews, right? So specific transactions that would come in front of CFIUS or Team Telecom or could be addressed through other means. And so trying to look at a holistic framework and solve for those two problems took quite a bit of time and to work through all the agencies that would have equities in those issues.
I'm excited to introduce a partnership with PolicyWare, bringing affordable, expert-driven policy education to all of you. Starting May 14th, Sam Sachs will be teaching a deep dive into China's digital governance and its global implications. Sam is an old friend of mine and a senior fellow at the Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. She's a leading expert on China's cybersecurity legal system, the U.S.-China technology relationships, and the geopolitics of data privacy and cross-border data flows. You'll learn over several weeks as Sam delivers live classes with options to listen on your own time. Policyware deep dives are designed to be attended alongside your jobs, and they'll help you organize with your employer for cost sharing. Help support ChinaTalk by registering for the deep dive in the link in the show notes. And thank you so much for Policyware for sponsoring today's episode. Let's come to the back to the case by case versus like holistic approach in 1 second. But I do want to get to the like, okay, it's 2.5 years, not two or not three, because this is like, you know, I mean, no offense. This is like, I guess, a 5 out of 10 on a level of urgency issue. And I'm sure at any point in time, you could have just been like, all right, pen's down. We got to do this. And, you know, those sorts of like time sensitive dynamics play out in different respects when it comes to other things we spend a lot of time talking about on China Talk, like export controls or what have you. So I'm curious, how do the like everyone, I'm sure, has an issue. You got 12 different agencies. You got a lot of stuff like. How do they just like, and at the end of the day, not everyone is going to say like, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. So like, what does a like moderate level urgency topic like end up needing to go from, you know, Devin and Lee thinking this is like a cool thing that needs to happen to like actually getting past all the concerns and, you know, like reconciling all of the track changes and becoming something that ends up manifesting in the world?
I think it takes a real, I think it takes two things. And I think this is true for any interagency process. I think it takes a real engagement in the interagency, both by the proponents of what you want to do, but also by the other folks who are engaged in it who, you know, may still need convincing. But I also think it has to have, you know, it has to have the sort of policy prioritization of the White House, right? Because at the end of the day, it's the president and CEO. And if the White House doesn't think it's a priority or doesn't, you know, or wants to go in a different direction, then I mean that's the ball game, right? Yeah, I think that's what it takes.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think buy-in from the administration was key, right? I think having the NSC recognize we needed a different solution to this problem. And I think also buy-in from the DOJ leadership. I mean, obviously our portfolio is one that they care greatly about. They see many of the transactions we review regularly and understand the drumbeat of this type of risk, which is featured in many of the cases that we review, right? And you know, them finding a need for a better solution, right? And we had tremendous support up the chain with this idea, which, you know, is sort of key to being able to navigate at the higher levels of the interagency, having buy-in from the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General.
Because they call HSS and say, come on, this is important. Let us do the thing. Like, why does, or they give you the hours to not, you know, review CFIUS cases? Like, how does that matter?
Oh, I think it's the former. I think it's their ability to engage with the cabinet members and say, this is a priority for us. This is a huge issue and it is urgent for DOJ. And so, you know, we want to work with you to make sure your equities are addressed, but this is a key priority. I think when the Attorney General says that, that carries some real weight in the interagency.
So let's talk about this case by case versus sort of holistic approach, which is an interesting parallel to what you started to see out of the Commerce Department, where, you know, you went from all these like reviews of 10,000 different applications to saying, no, sorry, China, like you can't get advanced chips and we're not going to like make exceptions just because this, that, or the other company like seems nice and has good lobbyists. You know, how does what was the sort of genesis of that idea and maybe like the challenges in trying to grapple with this in a more holistic way versus kind of the stuff that you kept seeing over and over with through CFIUS?
Yeah. So, you know, so we're the section in DOJ that's responsible for, we represent DOJ on CFIUS. We represent, we chair Team Telecom. We have, a very active involvement in the ICTS program and in all the other supply chain authorities, whether it's 889 or, you know, you can list them all off. And I think, you know, we're having the same conversations in CFIUS in a lot of cases, right, about data and about how we protect data. When is data, you know, when does foreign adversary access to data pose a risk? When is it a direct risk? When is it a third-party risk? You know, all of these, and we're seeing this cross sector, we're seeing this across business type, we're seeing this, you know, the first party context, the third party context. And I think that, you know, as you said, the desire to do something more holistic, more strategic is born from that experience. in some ways, it made the project easier than starting from a blank slate, right? Because we already regulate in a case-by-case way. We already regulate data security, right? We do it in T-Telecom with mitigation agreements. We do it in CFIUS with mitigation agreements. We know the kinds of measures that need to be put in place to secure data. We have years of experience doing that. What restrictions need to be in place, what cybersecurity measures, what policies, what protocols, so on and so forth. The challenge, I think, in taking something from case by case to something more holistic is that you're now writing rules, right? And these rules are not things that you can easily adjust on the fly, right? In the way that you can with case by case review, right? If there's some particular, you know, operational need to change something in a transaction in a case by case review, okay, so we just change it then, right? We just draft the mitigation agreement differently. But these are going to be rules that are going to set, you know, categorical obligations that companies have. And we have to make sure we do that in a way where we are addressing the risk, but that we're not, you know, let me put it differently, where we have the intended economic effect we want because we very much do want to affect certain things, but there are also certain things we don't want to affect, right? And so we have to get that balance right. And I think thinking through all the permutations of that is probably it is the most challenging thing. And I would also say that's probably the biggest challenge that the process ran into in launching the EO and the NPR to begin with, right? Just the years of working through, okay, well, what if it's this kind of company and if they do this kind of business, but what if they have this kind of vendor arrangement, but they've got this person on the board? I mean, just sort of every permutation you can imagine.
And I'll just add to the example you gave about commerce, right? You'll see in the EO and the ANPRM a whole lot of things that smell like export controls and sanctions, right? There's a reason for that. We do have some models that we already have that industry is familiar with and that we know work. And so we borrowed from those things to, you know, make the kind of transformation that Devin mentioned to a more holistic approach.
All right. This was a lot of preamble. What does this proposed rule do?
So at its core, what the executive order does is it allows DOJ to set up this new program that will prohibit or restrict certain types of commercial transactions between what we're calling a U.S. person and either a country of concern or a covered person, which is someone who is owned by, controlled by, or subject to the jurisdiction of a covered person of a country of concern, where that commercial transaction would afford the country of concern access to either bulk sensitive personal data or to government-related data. Now, the regulation itself sets out two prohibitions and three restrictions. So the two prohibitions that will be contemplated in the initial regulations are on data brokerage, in other words, the sale or leasing of access to data by a U.S. person to either a country of concern or covered person, or transfers of genomic data, which we see as one of the most sensitive categories of data. And so both of those will be prohibited in the initial regulations. And then the other piece of this is the restricted transactions, the restrictions. Now, restricted transactions are, you know, similar to prohibitions, but we're not outright prohibiting them if the transaction can be commenced with certain security measures in place, you know, physical and logical security measures and other types of data anonymization techniques. And the restrictions, there are three, investment agreements, employment agreements, and vendor agreements, right? Those are transactions where we do see national security risk, but that risk may be lower, you know, relative to the economic value of those commercial relationships. And so all of that is laid out in the ANPRM and will be, you know, further cooked out in the proposed rule. But that's the initial rule, right? We always have the ability under the EO to issue further rules as we identify additional risks.
And I'll say that those restricted transaction categories that Lee mentioned, those three, those weren't plucked out of thin air, right? We identified those based on the three kinds of relationships that we most frequently mitigate in CFIUS and Team Telecom: employment relationships, investment relationships, and vendor relationships. And so what we've done is we've taken the sort of lessons learned of the case-by-case review that we've engaged in, and we've translated that into a more categorical approach.
I get the investment and vendor relationship. What's the employer relationship?
So the employer relationship would be a company that has an employee that is a citizen of a country of concern and is in that country predominantly, right? And so basically we're looking at usually what bears out is that we would call like insider threat risk, right? You have an employee who is in that country and is a citizen of that country.
Yeah, think of a U.S. company that's develop software, and for some reason, they have a global IT team, right? And that global IT team includes someone who is in a country of concern, subject to all the compulsion and the political and legal framework that country has. And as part of that job, they have access to the company's sensitive personal data. That's exactly the kind of employment relationship we would be getting after.
Gotcha. All right. So we got a handful of countries. I don't think they'll surprise many folks. What is it? Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, China, Russia.
Cuba.
Okay, of course. No disrespect to Cuba. But sort of more interestingly, I think, were the specific data types that you guys ended up deciding to focus on. So we've got genomic data, biometric data, personal health data, geolocation, financial data, and certain kinds of personally identifiable information. Maybe first question, like, what didn't make it? Was there like a, who got cut at the last minute?
So let me answer differently, which is to say, I think, you could look at, I think there's a huge difference between a national security regime like this and a privacy regime, but you could look at privacy regimes like California law or what have you, and look at the kinds of data they cover, and it's a broader, longer list, generally speaking. Mm. I think that underscores some of the differences between a privacy regime and what we're doing. But I mean, things that are, let me give you the biggest example of something that's not on the list, which is expressive data, right? So videos, text messages, emails, academic publications, music, those sorts of things are not the sorts of things that are covered under this program.
It's also wouldn't cover the phone book, as we like to say. So, you mentioned a more narrow list of personal identifiers. The goal was not to cover every type of PII that already exists and is publicly available, like in the phone book.
Yeah, like Lee's phone number, which you guys just happened to put into the proposed rule if people have complaints. Very, very good job, showing not telling here about what is and isn't personally identifiable information.
That's right.
Yeah, but look, I mean, that's part of a transparent rulemaking process, right? Is that we do need to make ourselves available to hear input from the public, even if I protested having my phone number put in the rule.
Yeah, you also note that the ANPRM says that comments, electronically submitted comments are preferred as opposed to loading up Lee's voicemail. But, you all do you.
Do people still send, there's a mailing address there? Like, does that happen?
It does happen. We have not received any by a hard copy at this point, but it's still technically possible.
But as I understand it, and I think this is right, I don't think it's apocryphal. As I understand it, there is just tangent, but for export controls, there is a former BIS official from long ago who calls in comments for every rule that comes, he's retired now and what have you. But my understanding is that he calls in comments. First, kudos to him for keeping up with the all the changes in that area. But those alternative forms of submission do get used.
Yeah, I would guess that there's actually probably a high correlation between alternative forms of submission and quality. And that it's probably people in their 70s who just really still care and are into this. So good for you, Lee, to take the brunt of it. Hopefully you'll get some diamonds. So this data list, I don't know if this is a DOJ question or an ODNI question, but what's so scary about this stuff?
Let's talk about genomic data first. I think that may be it's a little bit unique, and I think maybe the easiest for people to understand. So at bottom, right, what we're talking about are counterintelligence risks. And what we're talking about is the ability of foreign adversaries to take some data and use it to influence someone in the U.S. to do something they want, or coerce them, or blackmail them, or recruit them to do their bidding, and so on and so forth. And so it's really any data that provides a point of leverage, that rises to a certain level of risk, that provides leverage to a to a foreign adversary, or that lets them identify those people to begin with, right? Genomic data is a little different. It has those risks, but I think, you know, genomic data also has a few unique aspects to it. And so, and I say I'm picking on genomic data because, as folks can see from the ANPRM, that's the category that we think is the most sensitive out of the data types because it's the one with the lowest proposed bulk thresholds. Right, genomic data exposes vulnerabilities in people and in populations, right? So genomic technology that's used to design like disease therapy can also be used to identify genetic variability in a population. And those variations can be linked to, susceptibility to disease and can be used for both good purposes, like treating those diseases, as well as nefarious purposes, like making things that are that target those vulnerabilities. You've got large genetic data sets that are used for, you know, ancestry and for solving crimes and for research. Those can also be misused for surveillance and for repressing, you know, segments of society, which we'll hear, you know, what folks have heard Matt Olson, the Assistant Attorney General, called transnational repression. And so those genetic vulnerabilities in an individual or in a population can be used for the same sorts of targeting and counterintelligence and blackmail, intimidation, and so on. The reason genetic data is so particularly sensitive, though, is that it's persistent in a way that like your bank account PIN or your IP address aren't, right? Those can be easily changed, but you can't change your DNA, you know, sequencing very easily.
Those are some like very scary talking points, Devin. I don't know how much further we can get in this conversation about that, but like just the, you know, like I sort of made a joke on the biotech 101 show about like, oh, they'll just design a designer drug to like kill Jordan Snyder and no one else. But like whatever intel is leading you guys to like be sketched out by the prospect of them like targeting like big swaths of nationalities is that seems really like real and worrisome. I don't know. Comment, response.
I think it's pretty worrisome. I mean, I'll say one more thing on that just to go a little bit further and say that, you know, the IC's been warning about this for a while, right? So ODNI put out, I actually think it was NCSC that put out series of bulletins. And one of those bulletins, they talk about how China has this track record. I'll take China for a minute, but China has this track record of collecting, analyzing, and misusing genetic data to track and repress the Uyghur community in China, right? And so I think that's one, you know, sort of publicly available example that the IC has pointed to. I think it's pretty worrisome.
Well, and I'll just add to that too. I mean, you know, ODNI has also sort of indicated where we've already seen Chinese companies making investments in the U.S. market, particularly in healthcare, in you know, companies that have access to this kind of data, right? So 2013, BGI, Beijing Genomics Institute, buys Complete Genomics, which held DNA sequencing on millions of Americans. 2015, you know, WuXi Pharma buys U.S. firm Nexcode, similar sort of situation, right? We, I think, are struggling to figure out what commercial reason a foreign adversary-based company should have access to millions of Americans' genomic sequence, right? But the Chinese have the ability to kind of exploit our open investment climate and to make investments into this sector that would give them this kind of data.
Sure. I've just like imagined the scary scenario with the personally identifiable information stuff. I think if you want to target a general, if you want to target a senator, it's like you can just have someone Google that and or like, you know, hack their phone or whatever and get there. But, the first thing that came to mind is like thinking about a national mobilization, like in like during a conflict or something. And using this data and having like AI generate calls from everyone's mother saying that, you know, their sibling is dying and they need to be like at a hospital right now instead of like muster at their barracks or whatever. Like, is that the sort of thing that like using this stuff at scale with new tools you guys are scared of? Or like what is so worrisome about the you know, not like, I don't know, sci-fi biotech stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. I mean, not just that specific example, but the ability to use big data analytics and similar technologies makes this a far more effective and targeted means of conducting espionage, of conducting blackmail, right? The ability to use technology to find the needle in the haystack has just been transformed over the last few years, right? And so this kind of data, I think, you know, you kind of gave the example of, well, you could just hack into a cell phone if you wanted to access, you know, a particular individual. But a lot of the data we're finding can provide a really, you know, clear picture of people's pattern of life. I'll give you an example. So in 2021, Duke does this study where they try to see what sort of data on military members and veterans and government employees they can buy from data brokers, right? And they buy, there are about 8,000 data sets they find that are related to those types of people, right? People who may be valuable assets because of where they work or the information they have. But some of the things they could find in those data sets are really revealing, like, for example, people who frequent casinos. That was one of the fields they were able to purchase on the open market, right? Combine that with some financial data about someone and what debt they might have. That's a really interesting data point for a foreign intelligence service to be able to exploit, right? So it's not, you know, it's not that we're not sort of kept up at night by the, we could just hack into a cell phone and find some of these things, but the kind of data that's out there combined with the type of technologies we now have mean that we can get very specific in understanding particular people's patterns of life and, you know, things that are innate about them or things that are sensitive about them that we can glean from all of that.
So why do you guys care about other countries knowing where people are?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's two things, right? I think one, there's the individual concern, right, about the sort of targeting that Lee was talking about, the targeting, the identification, the track, you know, tracking Chinese dissidents or tracking, you know, foreign dissidents in the United States, and then identifying those communities and trying to engage in tactics to repress them or suppress them or influence them. I think when we talk about geolocation data, I think, you know, it goes beyond that too. I mean, there it's the aggregated insights, right? I mean, we saw what happened in, I think it was 2018 when the Strava heat map got published of, you know, folks' fitness journeys and how, you know, researchers, I think it took, you know, it was very quick where researchers were able to, you know, take that information and try to map government facilities and map, you know, military bases and things like that. I mean, Twitter was a buzz. And so, you know, that's one data set from one company in one period of time. And you can imagine the kind of aggregated insights that would, you know, allow a foreign adversary to have if they had many data sets or, you know, a broader slice of data. So I think, you know, it's both the micro targeting concern. It's also the macro lessons. Yeah.
So let's talk about like how a regulation becomes a regulation. We are now in the ANPRM phase, where, you know, you put out this lovely 30-page document and like lots of people are going to read it and lots of people are going to get stressed out about it and, send you comments. You know, sort of scrolling through the list of like, it was like 175 questions or something that you asked folks was a really interesting one and kind of like an interest, like a cool tour of like where you think your homework isn't done yet. I'm curious sort of, you know, I'd love to hear you guys highlight particular open-ended questions that you are most kind of curious to hear from market players about their take on the matter.
Yeah, I think one of the big ones is where to set the bulk thresholds. You know, so back up, right? I mean, the program applies to sensitive personal data in two different contexts. It applies to sensitive personal data that's on certain government personnel and locations. That the threshold for that is zero, right? We don't want you to be able to target, you know, the director of national intelligence, even if it's just the director of national intelligence, right? That makes sense. But we also care about bulk data on non-government personnel, right? Non-government locations. And that's because in sufficient quantities that those data sets can be used to draw those aggregated insights we were talking about. And so the question is, what is the quantity, right? Is it geolocation data on 10,000 US persons a year that we don't want to go to a Chinese company or a Russian company? Is it personal health data on 1 million? What is the right number? And that obviously takes into account a lot of different factors. And it's also an exercise that really doesn't have a lot of precedent, right? How much data is too much data to go to a foreign adversary, right? It has to take account of risk. It has to take account of economic impact. It has to take account of smurfing concerns, right? The concern where you get below the threshold by you know, lumping together smaller transactions over time, and other sorts of circumvention. I think that's one area where we're very interested in feedback. And I think you're going to, you know, I suspect we're going to get a range of feedback on that.
And two others I would flag. So one is economic impact, right? You'll see there's some broad questions about understanding what this is going to cost companies, particularly with like the security measures, for example, that we'll be asking companies to deploy if they're going to conduct restricted transactions. And then to that point, second is the sort of the feasibility and efficacy of the security measures, right? We kind of outline in the ANPRM a menu of both physical and logical access controls, as well as privacy-enhancing technologies and data anonymization techniques. You know, how effective can that be at actually protecting a data set in one of these transactions? And, you know, how feasible is it for companies to deploy them?
How did the DOJ, like, you guys mentioned earlier on that, like, rulemaking is not something you guys do all the time. Like, how did this fall under the Department of Justice and not the FTC or another, like, organ?
So I think the right way to think about it is that this program, it's a national security authority, and it addresses counterintelligence risks. And it's counterintelligence risks that live in the private sector. And that's what DOJ does. We do it in CFIUS, we do it in telecom, we do it in, you know, civil and criminal enforcement of export controls, sanctions, and so on. And so the, you know, as we were talking about earlier, the risks that the EO addresses all arise from the kinds of data-related commercial transactions that we already regulate in case-by-case reviews. Now, it's not regulation in the sort of categorical sense of the, you know, the economic sanctions or export controls type program, but it is regulation, and it is regulation in a case-by-case way. And so, I think it was the combination of DOJ's focus on corporate compliance, which will be very important to making this program actually work and to actually addressing the risk. Our expertise in data security when it comes to national security risks, which is a priority area for us in Team Telecom and CFIUS, where we lead most cases involving these kinds of risks. We have, of course, with the FBI, a deep bench, deep understanding of the counterintelligence threats at the center of the program. And we already work with many of the companies in many different sectors on their own data security. And so I think it was that confluence of factors that really, you know, really made DOJ the right choice and ultimately the choice that the president expressed in the EO.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So the department, I mean, Treasury, like, they do CFIUS. They've had to hire a lot of people to, like, do CFIUS. I don't think the Department of Justice, like, has had to do this before. Is this what's coming down the pipeline eventually?
Yes. It's a new regulatory program. We're going to have to stand up a new program, a new unit here in the Foreign Investment Review section, which Lee is the inaugural head of. We're going to have to hire, you know, a significant number of attorneys, non-attorneys. And I think many of the work streams will look very similar to the work streams that happen in sanctions and export controls, right? I mean, we're going to have a team responsible for licensing. We're going to have for general and specific licensing. We're going to need a team responsible for targeting and designating covered persons and covered entities. We're going to need a team responsible for regulatory development. We're going to need a team responsible for, well, a team of subject matter experts, which we already have and can already draw on, but then we'll need to expand. And we'll need a compliance and enforcement team. Now, we're fortunate because we already have a dedicated compliance and enforcement unit for all of our CFIUS and Team Telecom and other matters. And so we'll be able to tap into the expertise of that team and that deputy chief to handle compliance and enforcement here. But you're exactly right, Jordan. I mean, we're going to need a significant expansion, and that expansion's already begun.
So do you have to, like, sell yourselves to Congress, or, like, who decides if Lee gets staff?
I think this will need new money, right? And I think that's true. That would have been true regardless of where you could hypothetically put the program, right? Any, it's a new regulatory program. There are no resources dedicated to it at the outset, as is typically true. And so any, you know, any agency that would implement a program like this would need a new personnel, a new office, and you know, website and a portal and so on and so forth. And so I think, yeah, we're working obviously, you know, working with OMB and Congress to make sure that we can secure the resources necessary to, you know, bring this program online.
And what happens if you don't? Do we just like not get the rules?
Well, we're going to continue in the rulemaking process. We're going to issue the next step is issuing the NPRM, which we'll do later this summer. And then we'll, you know, move forward on the rest of the program, including, you know, once that comment period is over, we'll have a final final rule out. With the comment period for the NPRM is over, we'll, you know, begin thinking about what our initial lists of designated covered entities look like and so on and so forth. But I think, let's not put the cart before the horse, right? Let's, I think that this is an area where there's a lot of, bipartisan or nonpartisan or cross party or whatever you want to call it support, and a lot of interest. I think there's been a recognition, across administrations, across party, across houses of Congress, that, you know, the threats foreign adversaries pose to our data are real, and that we have to have a way to secure it. And I think that, you know, I look forward to discussing that with Congress more.
Right. But like, what happens if no money comes?
I think that's a bridge we'll have to cross in the future.
Okay, fine.
What I will say is that I do think the program has to be effective in the real world, right? And there are two parts to making it effective in the real world, right? Companies have to implement it, and it has to be implementable, because the data lives with companies, and companies have to have compliance programs that are effective and that actually protect this the way we want them to. We also have to be able to run the program, and so we have to have the resources to do that. I think those two pieces have to come together.
Team Telecom, let's get the 101.
Sure. So Team Telecom 101. So Team Telecom, as you know, is an interagency body comprised of representatives from DOJ, the Defense Department, and Homeland Security. And that body is essentially tasked with reviewing certain types of FCC telecom licenses that have requisite foreign ownership or a foreign nexus for national security and law enforcement risk. And the committee makes recommendations to the FCC about how to adjudicate those license or authorization applications. Usually that's in the form of a mitigation agreement that would condition a license application, though on a few occasions, we've recommended denial of a license or revocation of a license. Some of the licenses we look at range from what are known as Section 214 license, which are traditional common carrier telecom services, to submarine cable landing licenses, to certain types of 310 media or broadcast petitions, right, where they all have this foreign nexus. Over the last few years, though, probably the big focus area of this committee has been submarine cables. And it's articulated in this EO. This is a space we see a lot of this kind of data risk as we've looked at the evolution of the cable market. So Team Telecom over the last few years has made some very significant recommendations on cable applications that try to get exactly at this kind of risk that the EO is all about.
Yeah. I think I got to do a whole show on subsea cables, but like briefly, why don't you give us the pitch on why they're cool, why they're interesting, why people should pay attention.
Sure. So most importantly, like 95% of the world's internet traffic now moves through a subsea cable, right? They're an extremely important piece of infrastructure for connecting the world digitally. But here's what's happened over the last few years. Traditionally, cables were owned by the telcos, right? Think of the Verizons and AT&Ts of the world as a means of moving their traffic between networks on, you know, different continents. But over the last few years, what we've seen is that cables are really part of the cloud. What we've seen is the cables being built by the large hyperscalers and the cloud operators really to connect their data centers on a global scale. In other words, to move lots of data around their architecture. And so now most of the cables that Team Telecom looks at are being built by Google and Meta and AWS and Microsoft. And so there's a very different national security risk profile that comes with those kind of cables, both in terms of the sensitivity of data that's running over those cables and the volume of data that's running over those cables. And so you have this piece of infrastructure that, you know, a decade ago, we weren't thinking much about, we now see as a really critical node and vector for this kind of national security risk.
I don't understand. Why is a Meta cable more worrisome than a, I don't know, a Verizon cable?
Because of what moves over it, right? So when those companies are building cables to connect data centers, what they're really doing is moving their backend data around the world, right?
So they, all your text messages, correct. All your Facebook data, all your, you know, yeah.
All your Instagram information, all your WhatsApp communications, all the things that a company like that would store in Google's case, all the documents you keep in the Google Cloud, right? Are really what they're moving. It's not sort of your traditional communications traffic, right? So it's a different type of traffic that has more sensitivity in our view. And the volume is just wildly different. The cables that we're seeing, you know, built now, you know, are starting to bend the laws of physics in terms of the amount of data that can run through them, which is really, you know, concerning from a security perspective of how that data is secured.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's not just Western firms building cables, but like Huawei has also announced lots of, you know, like China, Africa, subsea cables and stuff. I mean, like, what is your, you know, I think the famous thing was that that Team Telecom did in the China context was the China mobile license. But from a subsea cable perspective, what are the sort of like, I don't know, adversary nation questions that you guys think about?
Sure. So we usually think of two things, right? One is where does the cable land, right? Does it land in adversary territory? And then the second is the who owns it. Now, a lot of the cables we see are owned through consortium, right? It's not one company that owns the cable, but it's a, you know, a group of companies that all make investments into the infrastructure, and then they each own a part of it to move their traffic. I think the best example was what was known as the PLCN cable, the Pacific Light Cable Network. That cable originally proposed to land in Hong Kong, as well as Taiwan and the Philippines. And one of the owners was a Chinese telco, Dr. Pong, which I believe has been subsumed by China Unicom at this point, as well as the other two owners, which were Google and Meta, right? And so for us, when we look at that risk scenario, we're thinking about, you know, landing in Hong Kong, you know, especially 3-4 years ago, was very high risk at the time that the Chinese were sort of re-exerting their influence over Hong Kong. And second was the having the Chinese company in the ownership consortium, which would allow them access to all of the cable's infrastructure, right? Those are the kind of risks that we would think about that we sought to mitigate there. And ultimately what we did was recommend to the FCC that the cable not land in Hong Kong, which they got rid of the Hong Kong landing point, and to get rid of that one owner, which the consortium did, and then came back to us with a new cable application that only comprised Google and Meta, which we then entered into mitigation agreements with both parties.
And then just a couple of years ago, we, you know, we had another landing in a foreign adversary territory cable with the, it was the, I think it was the Arcos One cable that was proposed to go from Miami to Cuba. And that was the first public full outright denial that Team Telecom recommended.
And that had another interesting risk scenario, which was that, you know, like we see in many of these cables, the owners of the cables have the ability to lease capacity and allow others to use them. And ultimately, what we articulated in the recommendation is that the applicants for the cable itself were not the ultimate really customers of the cable, which was the Cuban government.
So like, recorded. So do you guys have like a authority fantasy draft? Like, you know, what like power would have made these 2.5 years much less painless? Or like when you see things and you're just like, man, I wish we could deal with this, but we can't because we don't have the power.
As someone who's dealt with this law a lot in the past couple jobs and this one, I would say that IEPA is a pretty good authority. Now, it's not a dream authority because it's an actual authority, but maybe an IEPA for the 21st century would be nice, right? I actually think dream authority for me would be an update to any of the authorities we already have, right? So like, take the Cable Landing License Act, yeah. Right? What was that,
1921,
right? 100 years old. I mean, yeah. We're regulating submarine cables, right? For right. Hyperscalers with fiber optic connections and the rest of it using the Telegraph Authority.
Yeah, this is where we're such simpletons. I'm like, man, just codify Team Telecom in a statute instead of an executive order. Would be on my list. And then I think there's definitely something I'd like to see the ICTS authority built out, which again may reflect a few years of trying to get that authority to work at Commerce. I'd like to see a little more there, including putting it in the statute to build that program out as well. But again, maybe I'm a simpleton with small houses.
I think that's right. I think, look, there's certainly room for Congress to complement what we're doing here, right? I mean, and what we're doing in a lot of different avenues in the government. I mean, with attempts to regulate things like WeChat, for example, I mean, was the limits of some of our existing authorities. And I think that the fact that we're relying on the 1921 cable landing license, the fact that IEPA is, you know, 1978, 77, there's just a lot of room, I think, for Congress to update these authorities in ways that are complementary to what the U.S. government's doing. That's my dream.
What a sad answer.
Oh, man, Jordan.
Maybe let's close on sort of like the Venn diagram of like lawyers plus like emerging technology plus national security. I mean, like, what are the sort of, this seems like a pretty tight talent pool that you guys are trying to pull from to be able to make thoughtful decisions about stuff like data flows and subsea cables and whatnot. You know, how are you guys thinking about hiring, upskilling? Like, what are the needs? What can and can't you get from the rest of the interagency? Like, what do you like wish you didn't have to rely on from the private sector to help answer these questions? You know, broadly on like the, you know, the challenges of taking on these emerging issues.
Sure. So, I mean, at least to the initial question about the talent pool, right? So technology experts is certainly one of the things we're looking for. And you're right, that it's a limited number of lawyers with tech expertise that can kind of speak to the program we're building. But the other thing we really need, we're looking for more rule writers. We're looking for people that have expertise in the Administrative Procedures Act and how we will build a regulatory program, right? We need folks that have expertise in things like export controls and sanctions and know how designation lists work and, you know, how we litigate those designations sometimes. So we need things like that too, right? One of the things we talked about that bring us back to the beginning conversation about FIERCE being a little different is that none of the people who work here have the same background. We all have different sort of expertise that we bring to the table. And I think we're going to look for the same. Right, is we're not looking for one type of lawyer here. There's a whole different array of talent we'll need to fill in, some of which I actually think we will be able to find because, you know, it's not just the sort of tech-centric piece, but, you know, no doubt we will need that as well.
And I think that's been hugely successful for this office. I mean, one of the things that strategy of bringing in just a very diverse set of backgrounds and experiences, I mean, it's been very intentional and it's worked very well. We've got folks who are former State Department. We've got DHS. We've got IC, you know, folks who are lawyers and non-lawyers. We've got, you know, we've got White House folks. We've got litigators. We've got prosecutors. We've got, you know, so on and so forth. And that's, I think, the key here, right? Is because all the problems that we're trying to solve are diverse and they're, you know, and they're complicated and they're complex and they have a lot of different perspectives that you have to bring to bear in order to solve them. And so what we do is we bring a lot of perspectives into the office and sort of, you know, maybe the old adage, right, that like maybe, you know, maybe one of us isn't enough, but all of us together are to solve the problem. And so I think we're just going to do more of the same when it comes to hiring for this and upscaling for this.
Yeah, well, this was unfortunately not a sponsored episode by the Department of Justice's HR department. But I guess if you're interested, you know, look up the proposed rule, find Lee's number and you know, go have a chat. I think he's got some billets to fill as long as Devin sweet talks the right Congress people. Do you guys have a data flows or regulation song to take us out with?
We'll have to think about that one.
Yeah.
I think we can come up with something.
All right. Devin, Lee, thank you so much for being a part of China Talk.
Thank you, Jordan. Too.
I'm just an average man with an average
We'll be right back.